told their stories to a grand jury, with Kirkendall finishing up to recount the history of heroin in the valley and the Klan's control. The grand jury indicted 34 people, including Felix Barella, Josefa Gallegos, Fat Jose Martinez, and his brother, Donuts. At 6 a.m. on Wednesday, September 29, 1999, a 5-mile caravan of law enforcement officers rolled into Chimayo as 3 helicopters buzzed like dragonflies across the skies. They seized land and motorcycles and Felix Barella's beloved lowrider, the Wizard. 2 months later, they seized his prized sorrel racehorse, Red Hot Mag, which his trainer had secreted out of the state, but bought back to race at the Sunray Racetrack in Farmington. After the horse won the 8th race, Kirkendall and his agent stopped the jockey leaving the track, produced the judge's order, and confiscated the horse. They went to the track office and seized the $22,000 in prize money as well. They later auctioned Red Hot Mag for $15,000. 15 acres of the Barella compound, where hundreds of addicts once used to buy, was deeded to the Boys and Girls Club. Without land, the Klans had no base of operations. Even after leaving prison, they did not return to Chimayo. But the story of the Chimayo Klans is important to our own because months before that bust, in April 1999, as Jim Kirkendall and his newly deputized agent sift through the Klan's history, a body turned up in Santa Fe. A 21-year-old Mexican kid named Aurelio Rodriguez Zapeta from the small town of Jalisco in the state of Nayarit was found in the trunk of a car, beaten and bloody. The town of Jalisco, Nayarit meant nothing to the agents at the time, other than it ironically happened to be the sister city to nearby Taos, New Mexico. Nor was the kid's murder especially intriguing, but the car in which Rodriguez Zapeta was found was registered to Josefa Gallegos, the heroin matriarch of Chimayo. So they stuck with it. As it happened, Rodriguez Zapeta was found with a cellular phone. The agents plugged the numbers found in the phone into a federal law enforcement database. One number turned up as connected to another heroin case that the FBI was investigating in Phoenix. Kirkendall called the FBI in Phoenix and spoke to an agent named Gary Woodling. Woodling had a strange story to tell. He was part of a group of agents tracking black tar heroin traffickers from the state of Nayarit, Mexico. From Phoenix, these traffickers had set up retail heroin cells across the United States in mid-major towns. 3 Nayarit brothers ran the Phoenix cell and seemed to have decided that wherever U.S. Air flew from Phoenix would make a good heroin outpost. These were not the traditional drug hubs of, say, Philadelphia, Miami, or Chicago. Instead, Woodling said, Nayarites were going to towns like Boise, Salt Lake, Omaha, Denver, Pittsburgh, even Billings, Montana. A local narc in Boise named Ed Ruplinger, in fact, had already run a sizable investigation into some of these guys, Woodling told him. Kirkendall and his agents went back and combed the subpoenaed phone records for the heroin clans of Chimayo. From the records, it seems that when the clans wanted to order supplies, they called a central number, apparently a dispatcher. This dispatcher, the records show, then quickly called the number for Aurelio Rodriguez Zapeta. It seemed the dead kid was some kind of black tar delivery man, being sent regularly to supply the Chimayo dealers. Kirkendall and the agents had long assumed that those who supplied the Chimayo heroin clans were an isolated group of Mexican dealers who had stumbled into the fertile heroin terrain of the Española Valley. Woodling dispelled this notion. As the investigation into the Gallegoses, the Barellas, and the Martinezes drew to a close, and 5 miles of police cars streamed to the Chimayo that day in September 1999, Kirkendall and his investigators knew they were onto something bigger. Enrique on top, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Robert Berardinelli knew a good thing when he saw one. When the Nayarit Mexicans came to town, this was, to him, a good thing. A balding man in his 50s from a family that owned a funeral home in Santa Fe, Berardinelli was a heroin addict. He'd been addicted to the morphine molecule since back in 1969. He'd smuggled pot from Mexico in the 1970s and done some prison time. He'd been desperate to get off dope for years. Tried methadone, but it didn't help. For most of his addiction, he purchased his dope from various Santa Fe street dealers. This was risky. His family had been active in public service in Santa Fe for most of the century. Berardinelli's had served as judge, city councilman, postmaster, and county treasurer. For him to be hustling hits of heroin on the street from people he didn't always know exposed him to arrest and his family to shame. But a lot changed back in the summer of 1997, he later told the detectives, when a group of heroin traffickers from the Mexican state of Nayarit showed up in Santa Fe, led by a guy who occasionally went by the name Enrique. Heroin had taken Enrique a long way from the toad. On the plane out of the Yuma airport headed up to New Mexico, on the day that he watched those migrants rounded up, Enrique knew this trip was his moment, the one he'd waited for. He'd been through childhood poverty, sold dope as a kid in the San Fernando Valley for uncles who underpaid him, then sold for that boss in Phoenix. He was married and had a lot to prove. He knew the business and was confident in his abilities as a salesman and motivator of people. Now in 1997, he was heading off to start his own heroin cell. Before leaving home, he asked his parents for their blessing. "I don't know if I'll be returning," he told them. Watching La Migra rouse those dusty immigrants from the Yuma airport put something of a closure on the last nagging qualms he had about selling Chiva. He arrived in Albuquerque, intending to make it the site of his first heroin business. But early on, he met an addict from Santa Fe, who said construction workers in that town were heavily addicted. He paid the guy $5,000 for an introduction to some addicts. He found Santa Fe wide open, no gangs, no competition. There, he set up the heroin cell that had been his goal for almost half his life by then. He brought in kids from his village. Right off, that felt good, to be an employer, a benefactor. He taught them how to drive, how to package heroin in balloons. He taught them the streets. He paid them $600 a week, plus all expenses, including the coyotes' fee to cross them into the United States. Soon his cell was selling balloons around Santa Fe. He returned to Nayarit. He employed almost 24 kids over the next 3 years from the poorest ranchos. They worked harder, didn't steal, and were grateful. Some wanted to work for a bit and then return home to party. Others, as he had, wanted their own business and would work for him only as long as it took to gain experience and capital. Either way, he saw their serious moods as he sent them off to go drive for him in northern New Mexico. Some pretended to joke around, but he knew it was a bluff. He knew how much was riding on their trips, a truck, a piece of land, a girl, the threat of many years in prison. Jalisco boys were church mice in the United States. That ended as soon as they got home. They were young men and wanted to party. Enrique liked to think of himself as a guy who took care of his employees, because he had been there himself. He took them to El Cuero's strip club in Vallarta, all expenses paid, or to beach resorts in Nayarit. No sugarcane farmer was ever going to get into one of those places. Meanwhile, he hired his mother a maid. He paid for his sister's quinceañera, the traditional Mexican coming-out birthday party for a 15-year-old girl. He paid for another to attend college. In a speech at her graduation party, she thanked her brother for all he had made possible. He took his family to fine restaurants in Topeka where they nervously rubbed elbows with the city's middle classes. He would look around these restaurants and realize that Chiva had finally allowed him to cross that river that separated his rancho from the world. "At least I'm not going to die wanting to know what's on the other side," he told himself. Enrique bought the land where he and his father were born. He hired men to help his father in the field. Seeing his son with some cocaine one day, his father took Enrique aside. "Be careful with that stuff," he said. "Don't use it." He admitted he had been a drunk for too long. It was the first time he had spoken to Enrique as a father should to his son. "That's all fine," Enrique said. But why didn't you speak to me like this before? His father said nothing. You have to change, he upbraided his father. No more yelling. Rancho fathers didn't speak to their children, but instead resolved every problem with blows or orders. Heroin changed that in Enrique's house. Still, there were headaches, the kind every small businessman faces. Enrique was constantly having to set up apartments for his guys in Santa Fe, getting them new cellular phones and Nextels. When a cop stopped one of his drivers, that car was useless. Finding new workers wasn't that hard. Many men knocked on his door back home asking for work. But making sure they were trustworthy and getting them up north and trained, that was a chore and costly, too. He lived in the rancho, but was always returning to Santa Fe to supervise, make changes, corral his workers, and get them straight. From Santa Fe, he soon discovered the huge heroin market in Tiny Chimayo, 25 miles north. He was content to supply the clans. With his black tar, the town that had endured decades of heroin addiction began to cave in. 2% of the population, 85 people, veteran addicts many of them, who had lived for years on weaker heroin, died of black tar heroin overdoses over the next 3 years. Enrique's networks changed heroin in Santa Fe, too. Now all Robert Berardinelli had to do was call a number. These new Mexicans had a delivery service just for heroin, like pizza. For years before they arrived, the dope was brown powder sold by junkies who would dilute it. Quality varied widely week to week. But the Nayarit guys didn't cut their heroin. They were always careful to deliver only balloons containing a standard weight of black tar heroin, which was uniformly potent. Most surprising, they didn't use their product. Every heroin dealer Berardinelli had known up to that point was a user, prone to cutting his dope. But these guys couldn't care less about using. They seemed interested only in making money. I always dreamed of that. I'm going to get clean and make some money doing this, Berardinelli said. Every junkie I knew had that plan and never did it. These guys were fulfilling every addict's dream. To Berardinelli and the street dope fiends, those Nayarit balloons became a brand every bit as dependable as a Coke can or a Holiday Inn sign. You always knew what you would find inside. One day the Mexicans asked if Berardinelli could find them a car. They would pay him in heroin to put it in his name. So Robert Berardinelli undertook another life, that of facilitator for a cell of Jalisco Nayarit heroin dealers. He charged them 3 grams to put the car in his name, and another 2 grams to insure it. Then the jobs multiplied. They asked him to wire their money back to Mexico, and he did. He put their pagers and phones in his name, and was paid in heroin. Occasionally, he would get a call from police telling him that a car registered in his name was being used by Mexicans who were stopped for speeding. He'd retrieve the car, and the Mexicans would pay him in heroin. When they asked him to find an apartment for a driver, he charged them 1 gram to find the place, 2 grams to fill out the lease application, and 1.5 grams to put the utilities in his name. Meanwhile, drivers rotated through every 3 months. They'd be taught the routes, Berardinelli told me when I tracked him down 14 years later in Santa Fe. They'd come up and make money and they'd be gone and you may never see them again. Some would be back 6 months later. They were just kids trying to make money. The American dream kind of deal. They said they were from Nayarit. They talked about how little money they'd make back home and how great it was that they could come and get away with this and help their families. Back home, they were doing farm labor. Any damn thing they could get with a lot of education. At a car lot once, Berardinelli met Enrique, who appeared to be the boss. He wanted to trade a Nissan for a Cadillac. Berardinelli signed the purchase agreement, and Enrique gave him 5 grams of heroin. Berardinelli spoke a little Spanish. Over 9 months, Enrique visited him often, usually with a request to put a car or a cell phone in Berardinelli's name. He always came with free dope. Berardinelli remembered Enrique liked to play the tough guy at first, and usually came with an entourage of 3 or 4. but he lightened up when he discovered Berardinelli was an old smuggling hand. Berardinelli told them stories of crossing weed southeast of El Paso in airplanes driven by former Korean War pilots. He offered them Cokes, since apparently they didn't drink. He never saw them high. Because of the way this business model ran, it was so much more relaxed, he said. There wasn't that element of fear in it. The dope was never cut. You got what you paid for. For a dope fiend like me, it was just really nice. I go from struggling every day to cop my drugs to having all the dope in the world, and all I have to do is put my name on a bunch of documents. They were giving me all the dope to do things I'd said I'd never do. Buy them automobiles, rent apartments. When you're strung out on that shit, you just don't think properly. Reason goes out the window. You compromise your moral compass. All I had to do was call them and they'd give me whatever I wanted. My addiction got worse and worse, like it did for a lot of people in northern New Mexico when they got here. Heroin like hamburgers. Los Angeles, California. One day in January 2000, 100 federal agents and police officers from 22 cities gathered at the DEA office in Los Angeles. Paul Rock Stone came in from Portland. Jim Kirkendall came in from Albuquerque. Others came in from Hawaii, Denver, Utah, Phoenix, and elsewhere to discuss a tangle of investigations into black tar heroin traffickers across the United States. These investigations had once seemed separate things, as if heroin dealers had independently sprouted in Maui or Denver. But in 1999, DEA agents in Los Angeles had received information that a heroin dealer in San Diego was being supplied by a couple out of an apartment in the Panorama City District of the San Fernando Valley. Agents obtained a warrant for the Panorama City couple's phone records. Oscar Hernandez Garcia and his wife, Marina Lopez, were from Jalisco, Nayarit, it turned out. Agents learned that Hernandez Garcia was calling numbers all over the United States from that apartment. They got a wiretap. They heard him arranging shipments of black tar, usually packed into the innards of electric ovens. Among the people Hernandez Garcia spoke to frequently was the man, who needed product for his stores in Columbus, Nashville, Wheeling, and Charlotte. They discussed the packages en route. Occasionally, the man, speaking English, followed up with Federal Express on packages that had gone missing. The list of cities Hernandez Garcia called grew long. With each new city, the agents contacted counterparts in those towns. At DEA headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, a supervisor named Harry Sommers watched these heroin cases mount all over the country. Sommers' job was to coordinate far-flung DEA investigations as they expanded. The Nayarites got his attention simply because of the number of cities involved. Most of the cases appeared to be pretty small-time, involving a few ounces of heroin at the most. What was new, though, what caught Sommers' eye, besides the expanse of the cases, was that the heroin was far stronger than typical street-level dope, but it was being sold cheaper than ever. Plus, the dealers were all from Nayarit, and as the cases poured in, they seemed to be everywhere in America. They were even in Boise, Idaho, which surprised Sommers. A while before, Ed Rupplinger had put an end to his case and arrested a half dozen of Poya's drivers and couriers in Boise. Poya, Cesar Garcia Langarica, was in Los Angeles at the time. A federal prosecutor wasn't interested then in pursuing the case to California or other places where Rupplinger had tracked the trafficker's cells. Poya presumably now lives in Nayarit. An indictment awaits him in Boise should he return to the United States. But at the time, Rupplinger never could get anyone to see that Boise was only a small part of a large web. By 1999, though, that attitude was changing. Sommers in Washington had never seen a system like this. These Jalisco heroin cells competed, yet borrowed dope from each other when supplies ran low. They were all connected, but the connections were easy to miss if you looked at each case individually. You had to see it from the macro point of view, Sommers said. He organized the January meeting of investigators at the DEA's LA office and dubbed the operation Tar Pit. That meeting made graphically clear the national scope of the Jalisco Boys for the first time. In Portland, the Tejeda Cienfuegos brothers were already the focus of something called Operation Nitar. In Hawaii, there had been a rare case of violence among workers at the cell David Tejeda had started years before. It had been run by two of his cousins, who were murdered in 1997 by their drivers whom they hadn't paid. In Phoenix, the FBI was onto several brothers, the Vivanco Contreras, who had stores in Arizona and other states, and sometimes supplied Enrique in Santa Fe. Oscar Hernandez Garcia supplied them all, and many others, from that Panorama City apartment. He had brothers who were veteran heroin cookers down in Jalisco and kept him stocked. At the L.A. meeting, an agent from each city got up and described the local investigation, what each was seeing. It was the same story over and over. Drivers would spend a few months working, tooling around mid-major cities of America with mouths full of balloons. Drivers were caught with only small amounts of drugs and thus were usually deported without even doing much jail time. The cells practiced just-in-time supplying like a global corporation. They presumed that anyone asking to buy more than a few grams was a cop. It was eerie how uniform the stories were from town to town, said Rockstone. What we were seeing in Portland is what L.A. is seeing is what Denver is seeing. These Jalisco boys are following exactly the same playbook. You couldn't help but feel how corporate these guys are, how standardized they are. It's like McDonald's, where you get the same burger in Louisiana as you get in California. Yet no single person called the shots. Rather than one large organization, the thing appeared to agents to be an agglomeration of cells, each run by small entrepreneurs, each with employees, all of whom knew each other through rancho connections in Jalisco County. Hernandez Garcia may have supplied them all, but that didn't mean he gave orders, nor were their profits funneled to him. His tap phone calls made that clear. He was just a wholesaler. They were retailers, relentlessly focused on the bottom line and achieving efficiency through technology just like any other business. The evolution of Nextel pushed to talk phones by the late 1990s was one example. It allowed bosses to monitor their drivers and make sure they were working through the day. In the room that day in Los Angeles, Jim Kirkendall listened and thought back to that first meeting in Chimayo a year before, amazed at what it had led to. The whole thing was like a web, and thus more flexible and resilient than the rigid hierarchies of so many Mexican drug trafficking organizations. And it all led back to that little town in one of Mexico's smallest states. Tar Pit, Panorama City, California. "You're cheating on me, you bastard," a woman yelled into the phone at her husband in Mexico. Marina Lopez was mad. Here she was in that run-down apartment, packaging dope all day. Her husband, Oscar Hernandez Garcia, was philandering down in their hometown of Jalisco, and now Marina was hearing the gossip all the way up in Panorama City. The argument escalated. "That's it, woman," Hernandez Garcia yelled into the phone. "I'm not coming back. I'm staying down here." Unbeknownst to the couple, narcotics agents were listening in. The marital spat sent jolts across the country to the highest levels of American law enforcement. It was June 12, 2000. By now, the case dubbed Operation Tar Pit reached across more of the United States than any other drug investigation in the country's history. The bust was set to take place 3 days hence. At the top of the indictment, the lead defendant, the guy around whom the case was built, was Oscar Hernandez Garcia, wholesaling heroin across the country from his Panorama City apartment. The June 15 bust date had been set weeks before by officials at the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, who had the job of coordinating dozens of law enforcement agencies in cities across the country. But it almost required the presence in the United States of Oscar Hernandez Garcia. And now, it appeared that a marital tiff was going to keep him in Mexico. Given icy relations between the two countries regarding criminal extraditions, he might forever be out of the reach of U.S. justice. Lisa Feldman, the federal prosecutor in charge of the case in Los Angeles, got on the phone to officials in Washington. "We can't change the date," she was told. "But he's my lead defendant. We've got too many resources committed. Sorry, it's got to happen then." For the next 3 days, Feldman and the agents waited on edge to see whether Oscar and Marina would make up. They did. Oscar Hernandez Garcia got on a plane to Los Angeles. Hours later, a SWAT team hit their apartment. They found dope in the dishwasher and money in a container of baby formula. At the same time, federal agents and local cops swarmed into apartments in Cleveland and Columbus, in Salt Lake City and Phoenix, and Maui, Hawaii. In Portland that morning, 108 officers met at a cavernous conference room at a North Portland hotel to discuss how they would hit 18 residences and another 15 cars. Rock Stone stayed up most of the night listening to Jalisco Boy's wiretaps, fearing he would miss something. By then, he had tracked these Nayarites to 27 cities in 22 states, a massive yet diffuse corporation of drugs designed to resemble a motley collection of street dealers and unlike any narcotics network he had ever known. At 6 a.m. in southwest Albuquerque, Jim Kirkendall and other agents burst into a two-story adobe-style house where Enrique then lived with a girlfriend and her children. They arrested another half dozen of his drivers. Later, Kirkendall sat down to talk with Enrique. He just portrayed himself as a poor guy from small-town Mexico trying to make a buck, as if there was nothing too wrong with what he was doing, Kirkendall remembered. A family guy looking out for his family and his kids. I talked to too many of the girls he'd slept with to believe that. He was a farm boy and a mid-level trafficker. Enrique spent the next 13 years in a U.S. federal prison. Across the country that day, 182 people were arrested in a dozen cities in Operation Tar Pit. Agents seized relatively small quantities of drugs and cash, 60 pounds of heroin and $200,000. Yet Tar Pit remains the largest case, geographically and in terms of manpower used, the DEA and FBI have ever mounted jointly. This is the first time we've seen a criminal drug trafficking organization go coast to coast, also hitting Alaska and Hawaii, DEA Administrator Donnie R. Marshall said at a press conference. The bust reflected the spread of Mexican immigration. Mexican immigrants were now coast to coast, too. They formed the working classes in North Carolina, Alaska, Idaho, Minnesota, and Nevada. Mexicans were the largest influx of foreign-born labor to the American South since slavery. They were in the biggest cities and were revitalizing parts of heartland America. The only locally owned new businesses in many rural towns were those that Mexicans started, and it was common by 2000 to find Mexican restaurants in Mississippi or an out-of-the-way burg in Tennessee. This also meant Mexican traffickers had more places to blend in. That wasn't even true 5 years before. But by the late 1990s, as Mexican immigration was now virtually nationwide, Mexican drug networks national in scope were now possible too. Such a thing was unprecedented in the history of U.S. organized crime. Not even the Italian mafia had done it, but Operation Tar Pit showed that the Jalisco Boys had. They were a new kind of drug trafficking in America. The Jalisco Boys weren't the General Motors of drugs. They succeeded because they were the internet of dope. A network of cells with no one in charge of them all, with drivers rotating in and out, complimenting each other as they competed for every junkie's last $20, yet doing this without guns, shutting down their phones fast as a website at any hint of law enforcement's approach. Back in Jalisco that August, the Feria del Elote was dead. Bandas came to town and left empty-handed. Most cell owners left for Guadalajara, believing they were on some DEA or FBI list. The man went on the lam and returned to Jalisco just before the Feria. The town dried up, he said. Nobody was coming to the plaza. He was arrested in South Carolina 2 years later and sent to prison. The case against him was based mostly on wiretaps of his conversations with Hernandez Garcia and with FedEx tracking the whereabouts of those packages of ovens stuffed with black tar heroin. In Portland, Rockstone would put together two more operations against the Jalisco boys, targeting a video store and a bridal shop that funneled crew money home to Nayarit, and sold the Jalisco networks their indispensable cell phones and pagers. He found an apartment that had 155 cars registered to it and shut that down too. Along the way, though, he came to a sobering conclusion. It wasn't just that the Jalisco runners were endlessly replaced. It was that even if Stone kept attacking management levels of these Nayarit heroin crews, the managers, too, would be replaced quickly. He'd never seen this in narcotics. Informants told him that the Tejeda Sanchez clan alone, with the Lermas, Diaz's, Bernal's, Cienfuegos's, Hernandez's, Garcia's, and the rest, were more than 200 deep back in Nayarit, and any of them could rotate in to a heroin crew in Portland as a regional sales manager or cell supervisor. Not only that, though. On the horizon hovered a specter even more disturbing than rotating squads of heroin franchise upper management, bizarre as that idea might seem. As Tar Pit took place, out in the east was swelling a wave of opiate abuse, creating vast numbers of new addicts as it swept west across America. Part 2. 2,000-year-old questions. Boston, Massachusetts. One spring day in 2000, Dr. Nathaniel Katz left his Boston pain clinic and crossed the Charles River to a hotel in Cambridge. Awaiting his arrival were 300 physicians and researchers attending a conference on infectious diseases. Katz had been a practicing pain specialist for almost a decade. He'd agreed to speak to the conference on how to manage pain in AIDS patients. He walked through the Royal Sonesta Hotel in his best suit, a name tag affixed, and a carousel of slides under his arm. I was nervous. A pretty young woman was there. I was half noticing her. She comes up to me and says, "Dr. Katz?" I'm thinking, great, my first fan, and she's a pretty young girl. I'm ready for adulation. "Nathaniel Katz?" she says. "That's right," I say. She says to me, "I've been waiting for 10 years to tell you this. You killed my brother, Peter." Nathaniel Katz had grown up in a Coney Island apartment near the elevated tracks. His parents, Eastern European Jews, survived the Holocaust and came to New York City in 1948. His father worked as a chemist with the city's transit authority. Katz finished high school at 16, college at 20, and went on to medical school. By 1986, he had graduated and was interested in studying the nervous system. He did a 3-year fellowship in neurology. He had no tutelage in pain management. No one did in medical school. "Just because it's a problem every doctor faces every day," he said, "doesn't mean that it's something you would run into in medical school." He was surprised, as a young neurologist, to find pain everywhere. Back pain, neck pain, headaches, muscle pain, pain associated with MS, Parkinson's, or strokes. Patients virtually clawed at his lab coat for help in managing their pain. "I kept on seeing these patients and not knowing what to do with them," he said. As it happened, Katz got his training in the first years of the debate within American medicine over opiates and pain. Everywhere, people quoted the notion, pried unwillingly from Herschel Jick's one-paragraph letter years before, that less than 1% of pain patients who were prescribed opiates developed addiction. By the time Katz was well into his medical training, a new conventional wisdom on opiates had emerged. It went something like this, Katz remembered. "It was not only okay, but it was our holy mission, to cure the world of its pain by waking people up to the fact that opiates were safe. All those rumors of addiction were misguided. The solution was a poppy plant. It was there all along. The only reason we didn't use it was stigma and prejudice. Once it became clear that pain patients weren't going to become addicted, we were now liberated to use that solution that had been in hand the whole time. My fellowship director even told me, if you have pain, you can't get addicted to opiates because the pain soaks up the euphoria." Now you look back and it sounds so preposterous. That's actually what people thought. You can think what you want in the face of 10,000 years of reality. But, young and dutiful, Katz prescribed opiates. Sure enough, some patients did well on the drugs, as his instructors said they would. But he noticed that just as many did poorly. They were running out of the drugs before the month was up, asking for more. The real problems were things I couldn't see. What was that patient doing with the medication when they left? Then Katz met Peter. Peter was incontinent and had numbness in his legs, the result of an injury to his lower spinal cord. Peter was also unemployed and an alcoholic. At the time, pain specialists and addiction specialists rarely crossed paths. Even today, despite a national movement to treat pain with addictive drugs, the two specialties, remarkably, still don't have much contact. There are no joint conferences where the two specialties might meet. So despite Peter's history of substance abuse, Katz prescribed opiates. Before long, Peter was asking for more before the end of the month. Katz hesitated, but Peter was a loquacious fellow. He charmed the doctor, and each month walked out of Katz's office with more medication. "I was faced with a dilemma that prescribers had," Katz said. "What is the nature of the problem? If it's an abuse problem, the patient's not going to tell you." Before Katz had a chance to find out, Peter died from an overdose of the medication the young doctor was prescribing. His death was a turning point for Nathaniel Katz. He was dead, and I liked him, and I wanted to help him. Katz had two questions. Are opiates safe when used to treat chronic pain? Are they effective in treating that pain? Katz searched the medical literature and found nothing. There's not a shred of research on the issue. All these so-called experts in pain are dedicated and have been training me that opioids aren't as addictive as we thought. But what is that based on? It was based on nothing. I felt I've just uncovered the problem of our age and of 500 BC. What are the risks of opioids? There was no answer to those questions, despite the fact that people have been asking them for 2,500 years. By the 2000s, the American pain revolution was complete. Most of the country's 100 million chronic pain patients were now receiving opiate painkillers, as it was accepted on faith that virtually none of them would grow addicted. They usually weren't receiving prescriptions from pain specialists. Their prescriptions came instead from general practitioners with little time and little training in pain management, the kind of docs Purdue Pharma targeted in its sales campaign. Doctors prescribed pills for wisdom teeth extraction, carpal tunnel syndrome, bad knees, chronic back pain, arthritis, and severe headaches. Football and hockey players were given them for separated shoulders. People were sent home with bottles full of 90 Vicodin or 60 OxyContin pills. In many cases, patients recovering from surgery, a half dozen pills might have sufficed, but doctors often wanted to avoid further patient visits. Why not prescribe more if the pills were now virtually non-addictive when used for pain? Americans were enjoying an era of amped consumer spending based on massive debt and towering real estate values that appeared to rise endlessly. It was a time when the country seemed a dreamland, where the old rules, constraints, and knowledge no longer applied. At the same time, a culture of opiate use grew from a medical revolution that believed these narcotics could now be used to treat pain without fear of addiction, that the old rules, constraints, and knowledge, in other words, didn't apply. Worldwide pharmaceutical opiate production rose steadily. But it was the United States, the country where the Englishman Robert Twycross once smelled the fear of addiction as he stepped from an airplane, that now consumed 83% of the world's oxycodone and fully 99% of the world's hydrocodone, the opiate in Vicodin and Lortab. Gram for gram, a group of specialists wrote in the journal Pain Physician in 2012. People in the United States consume more narcotic medication than any other nation worldwide. Drugs containing hydrocodone became the most prescribed drugs in America, 136 million prescriptions a year, as I write, and opiate painkillers the most prescribed class of drugs. U.S. sales of opiate painkillers quadrupled. Sales of oxycodone, the drug in OxyContin but also sold in smaller dose generic pills, rose almost ninefold between 1999 and 2010. A rising sea level of opiates spread to every corner of the nation. Before long, a black market for pills emerged larger than anything the country had seen. OxyContin very quickly had a street price, $1 a milligram, so $40 or $80 per pill. Between 2002 and 2011, 25 million Americans used prescription pills non-medically. Amid all this, opiate abusers began to get younger. In a 2004 survey by the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, 2.4 million people 12 years or older had used a prescription pain reliever non-medically for the first time within the previous year, more than the estimated numbers using marijuana for the first time. The pain pill abuser's average age was 22. Overdose deaths involving opiates rose from 10 a day in 1999 to 1 every half hour by 2012. Abuse of prescription painkillers was behind 488,000 emergency room visits in 2011, almost triple the number of 7 years before. Generic methadone, for years strictly an addict maintenance drug, suddenly started killing too. As media reports of OxyContin abuse and overdoses spread, some doctors began prescribing methadone for pain instead. Most doctors knew that methadone remained in the bloodstream for up to 60 hours. An addict on methadone could lead a daily life without the gnawing cravings every few hours of the far quicker-acting heroin. Thus, some doctors figured that methadone was an equally long-lasting painkiller. Plus, methadone was generic and cheap. Insurance companies covered it. Methadone prescriptions more than quadrupled, from under a million in 1999 to 4.4 million in 2000 nationwide, mostly for headaches and bodily pain. Many doctors, however, didn't understand that methadone, while it was long-lasting and therefore effective as a maintenance drug, was not a long-lasting painkiller. It relieved pain for only a few hours, so patients took more and more of it through the day to get pain relief. The drug built up in their bodies, causing overdoses. As methadone prescriptions rose, so did overdose deaths involving methadone, from 623 in 1999 to 4,706 in 2007. A decade after OxyContin's release, meanwhile, 6.1 million people had abused it, that is to say, 2.4% of all Americans. In macro terms, these were small numbers. But through history, illicit drug scourges have always involved a tiny minority of Americans. Baltimore, with a robust heroin market dating back decades, is considered the country's heroin capital, with the DEA and the city's health department estimating that roughly 10% of the city's residents are addicted. The crack epidemic at its height involved fewer than 500,000 users a year nationwide, according to SAMHSA estimates. But, as with crack cocaine, the numbers of new opiate addicts by the 2000s were enough to throw hospitals, emergency rooms, jails, courts, rehab centers, and families into turmoil, especially in areas where abuse was new. Subsequent studies showed that almost all those who ended up addicted to OxyContin had already used a small-dosed opiate pain reliever, Vicodin, Percocet, Lortab, which contained non-opiates such as acetaminophen or Tylenol. These pills were the first tentative steps doctors took in managing patients' pain as opiates became de rigueur. From there, some patients grew addicted. Street addicts had for years used Lortab or Vicodin, but in large amounts, the acetaminophen in these pills damaged an addict's liver. Plus, in many areas, heroin was not available or was so weak and expensive that addicts avoided it. What all that meant was that for a long time, people who abused these small-dose painkillers didn't often progress beyond them, and they rarely died from them. But in 1996, time to release OxyContin arrived, in doses of 40, 80, and for a while, 160 milligrams of oxycodone. OxyContin often served as an addict's bridge between these milder opiate painkillers and heroin. OxyContin contained only oxycodone, and much more of it. When Vicodin or Lortab stopped being enough, when legitimate patients asked for more, doctors now had OxyContin at 10 times the strength. And for those already addicted, not only did OxyContin pack a bigger dose, it was easier to liquefy and inject than the milder pills. All you had to do was suck off the time-to-release coating. You didn't need to separate out any Tylenol or acetaminophen. Oxy habits easily grew to 200 to 300 milligrams daily, quantities rarely possible with Lortab or Vicodin without causing massive liver damage. What happened next was what the man figured would happen when he first encountered OxyContin in Wheeling, West Virginia. Heroin use crept higher. Addicts' tolerance to OxyContin rose. Many stopped snorting the pill's powder and started injecting it for the stronger rush. Their habits hit hundreds of dollars a day. They were now fully hooked on the morphine molecule and no longer fearing the needle. They saw no reason not to switch to the far cheaper heroin. Others went to heroin much earlier because not only was it cheaper, but it could be smoked too. And they could tell themselves that they didn't need to inject it, which was true, while their tolerance was low. Either way, a government survey found that the number of people who reported using heroin in the previous year rose from 373,000 in 2007 to 620,000 in 2011. 80% of them had used a prescription painkiller first. But all this took years to become clear. Collision, Ground Zero, Columbus, Ohio. In another era, it's possible that Operation Tar Pit might have dismantled or permanently crippled the heroin networks from the tiny county of Jalisco in Nayarit, Mexico. But because they weren't like typical top-down drug organizations, the Jalisco Boys' networks coughed and sputtered, but did not die. The cell owners remained in Mexico and reconstituted their U.S. operations. Experienced drivers, meanwhile, used the vacancies Tar Pit created to start their own cells. Santa Fe hasn't been without a Jalisco tiendita since Enrique started it in 1997. Wholesale suppliers multiplied in the vacuum left when Oscar Hernandez Garcia and his wife went to jail. Competition lowered prices and expanded the supply of tar heroin headed to the United States. Meanwhile, more young men raised their hands to fill the driver slots. Most important, they were now recruited from families unrelated to Jalisco's first heroin clans. These new heroin workers had watched the families in the Tejeda clan prosper and wanted in on the business. Their entry into the business expanded the available heroin workforce and kept labor costs low. Soon the Feria del Elote was bursting with traffickers and bandas once again. Up in the United States, the boys no longer had to rely on the limited universe of older junkies. A younger and much larger population of heroin users was emerging, casualties of the nation's pain revolution. This synergy between pills and heroin happened first in one place. OxyContin's popularity was spreading west, just as the trafficker I call the man brought Jalisco black tar heroin east. They collided in central and southern Ohio. Roughly drawn, the region with Columbus to the north, and including parts of West Virginia and eastern Kentucky to the south, became the barometer for all that followed elsewhere in the country. Among the first to take its full measure was a doctor named Peter Rogers, who in 2003 was at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus in the Adolescent Medicine Department. Tall, thin, and spectacled, Rogers had specialized in addiction for almost 20 years by then. He'd treated kids on cocaine and crack. He'd seen them on meth, scratching scabs and grinding their teeth. He'd seen youths on ecstasy, LSD, pot, and as full-blown alcoholics. But before one evening in February 2003, Peter Rogers had never seen a teenager addicted to heroin. Rogers was at home that night when a nurse called. A 16-year-old girl was in the ER with her parents. The girl was shivering and throwing up. It was heroin withdrawal, her parents said. The nurses didn't know what to do. Rogers drove in, certain that it couldn't be heroin, and not sure what he would do if it were. The girl was small and blonde and looked like a cheerleader, but she had track marks up her arms. Her face was pale and worn. She had diarrhea and pains in her legs, stomach, and back. She said she'd started with pain pills she'd got from her friends. The pills got a little expensive. Boyfriend was a heroin user, and he injected her with heroin for the first time, Rogers remembered. She used for a while, then she'd run out of money. Her parents realized something was really wrong. She told them. As it happened, 2 months before, Rogers had taken a course in Cleveland on how to detoxify people addicted to opiates. He never thought he would actually use the information. I called the physician who taught the course. He said he had not seen any adolescents using heroin, but he gave me some ideas. I plugged her into an IV, hydrated her, gave her something for her nausea. I learned a lot from her. This first heroin addict was from the wealthy suburb of Powell, a fact that surprised Rogers almost as much as learning that she was only 16. Where do you get your heroin? From Mexicans. Where do you find them? She named a neighborhood not far from Children's Hospital that white girls from Powell did not frequent. Rogers kept her in the hospital for 3 days. He spoke to her parents. She had admitted she was a heroin addict and was now detoxed, the parents said, so she was fine and could go home. Rogers had a different view, one learned from years as a recovering alcoholic himself. If she doesn't get long-term treatment, she is not going to stay sober, he told the parents. She's going to die, end up in jail, or be a chronic underachiever. They didn't believe me, Rogers said. A few months later, the parents called. They said she's using heroin again. I saw her again, readmitted her. I think they were getting the message. Once he admitted that girl to detox that night in 2003, it seemed to Rogers as if floodgates opened somewhere. Word spread among addicts that you could go to Children's and get detoxed. Peter Rogers watched the new opiate epidemic emerge out of nowhere and file through his clinic. Hundreds of kids. They were all white suburban kids from well-to-do homes. Most were girls. One was a tennis champ. Another was the daughter of a Columbus cop. One was the daughter of a thoracic surgeon. There were several children of doctors, in fact. All had started with pills. Many said they'd seen friends die. They had no idea where else to go. The first kid showed up and got word out. I noticed that we got a lot of kids during that first 6 months from a place called Lancaster, a Columbus suburb. It turns out these kids were coming to Columbus, buying heroin, going back to Lancaster. Rogers was an early witness to heroin's new mainstreaming. The drug had for years appealed to rebellious kids from a seedy urban corner of America's counterculture. I remember at 11 and 12 years old seeing pictures of Sex Pistols bass player Sid Vicious and thinking he's the coolest, one 26-year-old recovering addict, a musician, told me. Sid Vicious, New York Dolls guitarist Johnny Thunders, Lou Reed, and William Burroughs, but also Charlie Parker. It was punk and jazz that made heroin so sexy and appealing, exciting and dangerous and subversive and not the norm. Then I saw the football players and the cheerleaders getting into it. These are people I turned to heroin to get away from. To the suburban kids hooked first on pills, heroin fulfilled the dream of the adventures they'd never had in their quiet towns. Part of heroin's new appeal was that it kept them at the edge of a hazardous yet alluring dreamland. Finding dope every day could take them on a wild ride through worlds they hadn't known existed, which, however scuzzy or harrowing, left them with fantastic stories that awed their peers. You're as much addicted to going and buying it as to going and using it, one addict said. You feel like James Bond. It's a crazy fantasy. By the end of that year, Nationwide Children's Hospital, which had never admitted a teenage heroin addict that anyone could remember, had protocols for treating them. Rogers asked them all where they got the heroin. Mexicans, they said. Rogers called Columbus police. An officer told them they knew that Mexicans were selling the dope. We arrest them, the officer said. In a day or two, another comes in and takes their place. Meanwhile, Rogers said, I was living at the hospital. I was taking care of these kids. None of the other physicians really knew how to treat this. We were not ready for this. It was a whole new phenomenon. I called all over the country. What we were doing in Children's Hospital in Columbus was not something that anybody else was doing that I could find. We kept treating these kids. They kept coming in. Rogers battled with insurance companies, who had apparently never heard of treating heroin addiction in teenagers. A couple years in, he gave a speech at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Pediatrics in Boston, describing what he was seeing to a sparse and bewildered audience. They weren't seeing any of this. They were thinking, why do we need to learn about this? Canaries in Coal Mines, Portsmouth, Ohio. For years after it closed, David Proctor's Plaza Healthcare Clinic would be known as the boot camp for dirty docs. But Proctor's influence went far beyond the unscrupulous doctors he brought to town. Instead, he showed Scioto County that starting a pain clinic was easy. Given an opening in Ohio state law, all you had to do was lease a building and hire a doctor who had a DEA permit to write prescriptions for Schedule II narcotics. Pain clinics were now sprouting up across America as the opiates became commonly used for chronic pain, and the under-treatment of pain was identified as a public health problem. Not all pain clinics were pill mills, but as opiates became the principal treatment for pain, the pain clinic was often prone to abuse. It attracted patients relentlessly demanding drugs. Doctors found it hard to maintain standards. Some clinics were never legitimate, but many others started with good intentions and were simply pushed off course by patients' constant demands. No place in America had more of these shady clinics per capita than did Scioto County, Ohio. Over the first years of the new century, a local junkyard owner, an attorney, a prison guard, an ex-bailiff, and a couple of convicted felons, as well as several doctors, all opened clinics, hiring doctors with permits to write the prescriptions and see patients at a rapid clip. Jody Robinson cashed in his car stereo shop to open a pain clinic, through which he became, according to a later indictment, one of the region's biggest pill distributors. Portsmouth became America's pill mill capital. The clinics were some of the only locally owned businesses to form in decades in Scioto County. People said the area's entrepreneurial spirit had drained from Portsmouth. In a twisted way, the pill mill showed that locals could still be as entrepreneurial as anyone. Billboards for pain clinics greeted travelers along the highways entering town. Drug dealers and users for miles around came to Portsmouth to stock up on pills. One key to the pill mill explosion was the discovery of locum tenens lists, a clearinghouse for doctors around the country seeking temporary employment. Many of these doctors were desperate. They had license problems or couldn't get malpractice insurance or were alcoholics. These were the docs Proctor had hired. Now other clinic owners did the same and quacks flocked to Portsmouth. Tracy Bias, a convicted felon, opened three pain clinics and hired doctors from New Mexico, Michigan, and Iowa, as well as two from other parts of Ohio. Clinic staffers, or locum tenens doctors, found work at a pain clinic, learned the business, and then went out on their own. Soon, plain old drug dealers got in on the scam. Kevin Huff, a longtime marijuana dealer, set up a trailer alongside a highway in Chillicothe, Ohio, hired a nurse, and sold so many pills that he had shoeboxes full of cash lying around his home. Several of the new clinic entrepreneurs had worked for David Proctor. Nancy Sadler worked for Proctor and then ran Fortune Williams Clinic. After Williams went to prison, she and her husband, Lester "Ape" Sadler, set up their own pain clinics. Proctor's one-time attorney, Gary "Rocky" Billiter, opened a pain clinic as well. After Proctor's arrest, his employees, Denise Huffman, and her daughter, Alice Huffman Ball, opened Tri-State Healthcare and Pain Management. A DEA investigation later found that people would drive for as many as 10 hours to the Huffman's clinic, pay $200 in cash to sit with a doctor and get a prescription for OxyContin, Lortab, Percocet, and other pain meds. The mother and daughter hired temp agency doctors and threatened those who refused to prescribe pain medication. Several physicians left immediately. In April 2003, the Huffmans solved their labor issues when they hired a Chicago chronic pain specialist named Paul Volkman. Volkman was so prolific that the Huffmans had to open their own pill dispensary in the back of Tri-State After local pharmacies refused to honor his prescriptions, this pharmacy was somehow legal under Ohio law. By September 2005, Volkman had written prescriptions for 1 million pills of various kinds. Another 1 million pills were deemed missing due to the lack of any records kept by him or the Huffmans. A DEA investigation estimated that Volkman and the Huffmans took in some $3 million from patients paying $200 a visit and who lined up well before the clinic opened. The Huffmans paid staffers in pills, but staff also accepted bribes, in pills usually, to move patients up in line. Volkman rarely performed anything resembling a diagnosis. Instead, he met with patients briefly, asked them a few questions, one of which was whether they were undercover law enforcement officers. He often ordered urine tests, but ignored them when they showed high level of opiates. He had one patient sign a death waiver, in which the patient acknowledged he might die from taking what Volkman was prescribing. At least 12 patients did die while Volkman worked for the Huffmans. He later opened his own clinic in Portsmouth, then in Chillicothe, and 6 more patients died. For a couple months, Volkman even had a clinic in a house on a residential street in Portsmouth's Hilltop neighborhood. "He was in one of the bedrooms," said one addict. "The front room was the waiting area, and the kitchen was where you got your blood pressure checked out. He wrote me some crazy amounts of medication, 480 pills 1 month, no MRIs, no CAT scans, no nothing." There were other pill mills. Volkman and the Huffmans were only part of the story in Scioto County. But not many in the county paid much attention to what was developing in and around Portsmouth. The area was abandoned by politics and power, and even by many who once lived there. Plus, those who remained behind, who were the first to get caught up in the gathering storm, were complicit in their own degradation, so no one paid them much attention. Folks like those from the Lucasville Bottoms. I was poking around southern Ohio, trying to understand all this, when I encountered a lawyer named Joe Hale. Hale has silver hair, a baritone voice, and a Marlboro Red always at the ready. By 1999, he had been a defense attorney for 15 years in Scioto County. A country boy from the Oak of Appalachia, Hale had a client list that was mostly court-appointed. The money wasn't great, but it kept him busy and in the courtroom. One place Hale made a lot of money was Lucasville. Lucasville is a small town a few minutes north of Portsmouth along Highway 23. It has a prison that holds Ohio's death house, where death row inmates are executed. Across the street from the prison is a high school. Lucasville also includes a couple stoplights, a gas station or two, and a few failed restaurants. But to Joe Hale, Lucasville was the Bottoms. The Lucasville Bottoms are flatlands that flood every decade or so when the nearby Scioto River rises. The rest of the time, the Bottoms provide cheap housing, most of it the single-wide mobile home variety. Many of its residents are on federal disability. Many of them are small-time criminals. Joe Hale had defended hundreds of Bottoms residents through his career on charges of drug possession, domestic violence, and drunken disorderly. The Bottoms are a clannish place, but Hale became well-known there. He got used to the rhythms of the Bottoms, which revolved around government checks on the first of the month. People rarely visited a doctor, and when they did, it was to guys like David Proctor, who accepted cash. In the late 1990s, as David Proctor was heavily prescribing OxyContin, a client named Tony Blevins showed up to do some work on Hale's house with a bottle of pills. Blevins called them OCs. He offered Hale a few. Hale had no interest in the pills, but he noticed that several of his usually energetic construction workers were like zombies. He came to find out people in the Bottoms were crushing the pills and injecting them. Most Bottoms denizens didn't know how to do that. A profession called shooters thrived in the Bottoms for a while. For a free hit for themselves, shooters would inject users who were new to the needle. "Over the next 3, 4, 5 months, Oxy was all you heard about," Hale said. "Some people were very experienced, very well known, with years as drug users. They started overdosing and dying. Because they were people with criminal records and never made a contribution to society, nobody gave a damn." This had been going on for a while, to Hale's growing alarm, when in April 1999 Jack Burton paid him a visit. Burton was the unofficial godfather of the Lucasville Bottoms, influential among many families, rumored to be involved in crime. A gaunt fellow, Burton drove a white sedan, and in it, slunk down behind the wheel, he cruised the Bottoms. Burton's daughter, Jackie, had just died of an OxyContin overdose. Hale had defended Jackie Burton after a couple barroom brawls that landed her in court. The first time Jackie Burton was shot up with OxyContin, she nodded off, and the shooter who injected her wasn't paying attention. She was probably dead for an hour before anyone noticed. Now Jack Burton was in Hale's office, asking what he could do about the company that made the drug. "Jack," Hale told him, "you're asking me to take on a major pharmaceutical corporation." He turned Burton down, but months passed, and the deaths in the Bottoms mounted. Hale kept thinking. "This is a lawsuit that could mean a lot of money," he said. In May 2001, Hale filed what is to believe to be the first Oxy-related wrongful death lawsuit against Purdue Pharma on behalf of Jackie Burton. Purdue Pharma has unleashed a pharmaceutical atomic bomb into the free flow of commerce with absolutely disastrous consequences that they should have foreseen, he told the Portsmouth Daily Times. A Cincinnati law firm eventually joined Hale's case, preparing it as a class action lawsuit, and asked Hale to find more plaintiffs. Hale found petty thieves and able-bodied disability recipients, people whose already dysfunctional lives had been further mangled by opiate addiction. Several months later, the Cincinnati firm withdrew from the suit. "Nobody told me a class representative shouldn't have a bunch of felony convictions," Hale said, "and that there were all these ideals that these class action plaintiffs were supposed to have." The Bottoms sure didn't produce anyone that a TV camera or jury would find sympathetic. After a few court hearings with him at one table and six or eight well-dressed Purdue attorneys on the other, Hale dropped the suit. But he always saw the Lucasville Bottoms as an early warning sign that Ohio and the country ignored at their peril. A Purdue Pharma press release later noted that the company had won every suit filed against it. That didn't surprise Joe Hale. By the time you were in a position to have a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, you were already likely to have fucked up so badly that you wouldn't work as a class action plaintiff, he said as we drove around the Bottoms one spring day, down lanes of narrow mobile homes and junk cars. But that's how it was as the opiate epidemic took shape in southern Ohio beginning in the late 1990s. Portsmouth, the Lucasville Bottoms, and other forgotten places of America nearby acted like the canaries in those now shuttered Appalachian coal mines. Just no one in the country listened much until more respectable types sounded the same alarm and famous people died. 50-100 cases a month. Olympia, Washington. The state of Washington's workers' compensation system is one of only five in the country that hold monopolies on insuring workers. The state insures two-thirds of all Washington's 1.2 million workers. It oversees the rest, workers at companies large enough to insure themselves. Thus, labor and industries, as the system is known, generates enormous amounts of data about worker injuries and deaths. As narcotic painkillers became accepted treatment for chronic pain, workers with on-the-job injuries were mightily affected. Almost alone in the country, L and I, in a three-story glass building off in Tumwater, Washington, far from Portsmouth and the Lucasville Bottoms, sat atop a mountain of data affording a broad vista of what was forming. Seeing it all, however, would require someone with an abhorrence of disorder. That described Jamie Mai. Mai grew up in post-war Vietnam, the child of a South Vietnamese Navy seaman imprisoned in a communist re-education camp. In 1978, her mother took her six children aboard a small fishing boat with 75 other people. They floated aimlessly, besieged by Thai pirates, on a boat crammed with people retching violently, until a Malaysian merchant ship happened by and took them aboard. A year later, Mai and her family were on a plane to Seattle and a new life. Mai got a pharmacy degree at the University of Washington. She worked as a pharmacist at various hospitals. In 2000, Wanting to start a family and looking for more predictable hours, she took a job as LNI's chief pharmacist, overseeing the cases of workers receiving prescription drugs.